tomé por un época. Si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement, with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. We meet Jay Tracy, an artist, entrepreneur, and trauma educator whose work lives at the intersection of creativity, compassion, and community. For more than a decade, she's brought color and care into the world, running a mural company that transformed public spaces, guiding divers as a certified PADI dive master, and producing media to help children understand the power of boundaries. Her heart for service has taken her across states and seas, volunteering with Special Olympics in Hawaii, Oregon, and Virginia, and showing up for her neighbors with grassroots mutual aid and outreach programs like Food Not Bombs, Union Gospel Mission, Love in Action Hawaii, and Home Hate Hawaii. Today, Jay leads Boundary Bandits, No Excuse for Abuse, a creative education project that empowers children to recognize harm, build emotional safety, and grow up clear, confident, and protected. Her work is rooted in the belief that every child deserves to feel safe in their body, voice, and story. And that change begins with empathy and education. Because the truth is, children can't stop abuse alone. They need adults, communities, and systems that are willing to see the signs, that believe them, and can act before harm has the chance to take root. The question is, will we notice in time? Jay, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure having you. And before we get into anything, can you tell us a little bit of what you're currently working on?
Yeah, actually, so you mentioned it in the intro. My current project right now is Boundary Bandits, No Excuse for Abuse. And that is a set of educational materials, including cards, posters, and short video clips, kind of like what you would see on a social media reel. And they're cinematic presentations of boundaries spoken by children. And this is because we're in a world where the media and the tech is kind of speeding up. And, you know, the things that we had in the past helped for the mindsets that we had then. But I think now we're in a place where we have a lot more education, a lot more data to work off of, and we can go a little bit deeper on the emotional level with kids. And also, we're in a much bigger need to have widespread protection with the internet and, you know, with unfortunately, there are where there are children, there are child predators, and that is across the board. It doesn't matter if it's a child in film working as a child actor or somebody growing up in poverty going to a public school. I think that they all deserve access to the same education on how to spot safe adults, understand safe and unsafe touch, and how and when they should speak up, run away, or contact a safe adult.
Can you tell us a little bit more about these support systems? In your experience, what kind of support matters most in the immediate aftermath of something that takes place?
I think if you are, you know, from a diving perspective, it's always important to the best action is prevention. And so I'm also still going to answer about how to support somebody after, but you really want to start by catching it before it happens. Something that happens far too often is that people don't know what they're looking for, especially if they grew up in an environment where they were secure and supported. And their view of the world might be very positive, and that might blind them to the intentional actions of people who want to cause harm. And I think if you are somebody who is savvy about what to look for, and you can also teach your kids to be that savvy child who understands the realities of the world at their age appropriate level, I think you can prevent a lot of issues. But if it comes to the case where you have been unable to catch something until after it happened, I think the best support you can do first is to fully listen and ask questions and get the details as soon as possible about who was involved, what actually happened, and show up supportively. Because it seems basic, that seems like it would be the natural step, but a lot of times people get in their own feelings about what happened to somebody else, and they place their own comfort before the harm that's been done to a victim, especially someone who is vulnerable and can't defend themselves. And a lot of times that might show up as placing their religion before the comfort of the victim. It might show up as not listening. It might show up as wanting to hear the side of the abuser before believing the victim. And I'm not saying just blind belief in everybody, but I am saying to ask the right questions, use your discernment, and really get the details, because the next thing you need to do is document and report. And you can't do that if you don't listen and ask questions in the first place.
Do you feel, after getting involved in this work, that we are headed in the right direction with this? What are some noticings that you have thus far?
I think we're a mess. I think we're a mess, and that we might just be at the point where it might be time to scrap the current system and build something new in its place. I think that the system we had might have worked for the industrial age and different times, but now we're in the information age and times have changed. The threats are different and the access to children is different.
Mm. You know, as a superhero today, you have put your cape aside, and we're so grateful that you've joined us today to talk about your work, but also some of the things that you had to deal with growing up. Before we get into that, what are the ways that you believe parents can step in, or family members can step in, when they think they notice something that's not right?
You know, I've been doing a lot of work with social workers in the UK who have different systems that are a little bit more advanced than what we're doing here in the US. And I just had this beautiful conversation with a social worker from Hamburg who gave me some more pointers on how to spot kids who might be going through something. And we already kind of know about disassociation, kids who are checking out and not showing up, a change in behavior. If your child used to be outgoing and gregarious and fun, and now they're reserved and closed off and timid and scared, you might want to check on that. Or if it only happens in certain spaces with certain people that their personality changes, you might also want to get curious about that. And then the flip side is that a child who's been raised without boundaries might have no sense of stranger danger, and they might be way too comfortable in inappropriate ways with adults who are not safe, or any adult without any discretion. Mm. Another way to spot things is if a child's eating habits change, if they stop eating like they used to, or if they overeat, like they're trying to comfort themselves or hide from something, if they start getting hyper-focused on either attention or hiding. There's lots of changes in behaviors, I think, that you can kind of look out for. But basically, I would just, it helps if you know the child, or mm-hmm. if you're seeing them consistently.
You know, a lot of times we live experiences to kind of learn how to be who we are now. And right now you are an internet sensation. You're speaking around the world. You are doing so much to kind of support women, parents, and children. I can't really imagine how difficult things were. If you can let us understand, how did you get involved in this work and tragically had to learn by experience in order to get to where you are right now?
Thank you for asking. I was the oldest in my generation in my family. I had about 22 cousins growing up, and I come from a family that is largely dysfunctional. The generational trauma goes pretty deep. My great-grandparents on my mother's side are from Germany, and they grew up in a time when beating your wife and having domineering possession of your family was the role of the man. And unfortunately, they never really grew from that. So the furthest back of abuse that I know began with my great grandpa. And it's tough to reconcile that in my head, because by the time he was an old man when I met him, he was a loving grandpa, but that just wasn't the case for his own children and wife. And that got passed down to my grandma, who actually did a lot of work to heal from the abuse. And she was never outright abusive in that way, but she turned to religion in a way that became harmful to the people around her. She kind of overcorrected to the point of restricting her kids. And that is kind of the theory in my family of why my mother, I don't actually call her my mother, I just refer to her as Tanya. But theory in my family about why Tanya became the way that she is partially her neurochemistry from how she was born. People have said that she's just kind of had this personality straight out the gate. And then that it was exacerbated by the strict religious upbringing that she had with my grandma. And it does show up. Tanya's very, very rebellious. She I don't think she's capable of empathy. She's got cluster B symptoms. My therapist, without being able to treat Tanya, but from the way she's had to treat me, has diagnosed my mother as a possible malignant narcissist. And what that meant for me is that I grew up in a household where the people who were supposed to be my caretakers were doing meth, drinking all the time. They were going on long drug binges. They were leaving me alone to care for the gaggle of children that belonged to her and her party friends. I have a special needs little brother who had birth defects due to the drug use that was going on during pregnancy. And which, you know, one of the issues that I grew up with that made it very hard for people to listen to me and believe me when I was asking for help to escape these harmful situations is the fact that Tanya is a very skilled manipulator. She's very, very skilled at masking. And even to this day, she has an entire business of health and wellness built on the premise of her son with this incurable disease. But she doesn't mention how he got that way. She doesn't mention the drug use. She presents herself as a healer in her small community where people don't question anything. And when I was growing up, even when CPS and social workers were called, she was able to charm police. She was able to charm social workers. She was able to charm school people. And when she couldn't charm them, she would rage at them. And either way, she was very good at blocking us from the help that we needed. And because of this, she was able to treat us like currency. She allowed, I don't know how much I can say on the podcast, how graphic I can go. But she did allow sexual abuse. She helped with the sexual abuse in exchange for living expenses and not having to work. She subjected us to pretty intense abuse with different men. And then one man in particular, his name was Travis. She had us, he was beating my brother, he was beating me. There was a lot of psychological abuse. There was just a lot of maliciousness, a lot of, they would have us, because they were drug addicts who were constantly stealing from other people. Tanya always kind of had this thing where she didn't want to get her own hands dirty. So she would get my brother and I up in the middle of the night to do everything from stealing mail, back in the 90s, you could still get your prescriptions mailed to you. So we would steal pills and things out of people's mailboxes. She would have us going to construction sites in the middle of the night to steal copper wire so that she could turn it in for money. Anything but getting a job. Anything but that. You know, and then at one point when too many people... So I grew up mostly in Oregon. I was born in Seattle. She moved us down to Oregon. And then when she burned too many bridges in Oregon, she reached a point where one of her own party friends actually called our grandparents to have my brother and I taken away. And they immediately drove down. Tanya was passed out from another bender. She would come back from these benders and she would be asleep for 2, 3, 4 days at a time. So even when she was back, she wasn't ever there to take care of us. And So my grandparents came down. They actually took us twice. The first time they took us was when that friend called, Aunt Tanya, and they took us back up to Washington, where we got about 9 months of peace and rehab. And they actually paid off all of Tanya's tickets. They bought her a new car. They paid off all her debt. They paid her rent, and they spent $15,000 to put her in rehab. And Tanya walked out of rehab. She wrecked the car within 2 months. And then she got police officers to come to my grandmother's house and actually take us back. And at that time, she had become involved with Travis, who was already a convicted sex offender. And she was able to still use police officers to remove us from the safe environment with our grandparents and put us in the care of the convicted sex offender with Tanya, who had just walked out of rehab. And she was in there for meth.
Mm. You know, first and foremost, I just want to thank you for sharing your story. And we are sorry to hear that children have to deal in that way. And I know that there's so much that we need to keep talking about, but I wanted to just pivot a bit. When the harm comes from trusted adults, how does that shape your understanding of safety as a child? I know that you were the oldest and you had to oversee a ton of children that were not relatives of yours at many times, deal with babysitters. There was so much that you had to do early on. How did that feel for you, if you could remember, around safety and trusting adults?
I don't think I ever had a sense of trust or safety. I think in my mind, the concept of feeling safe was something for quote unquote rich people, because the only time I had ever felt safe was with my grandparents. And they did do well for themselves. They made their money. They each worked hard for that. And I think I learned to be radically self-reliant. And, you know, at a very young age, I was lying about my age because I was babysitting. And then I also needed to find us food. I needed to get us ready for school. You know, the things that an adult would normally do. So I was a very parentified child. And I always grew up with the belief of nobody else is going to do it, so I have to. And, you know, and I did what I could at those ages, but I don't think there was ever a sense of trust or safety. And that's actually something I still struggle with to this day, is I'm very hypervigilant. And I can appear calm and easy, and I logically know when I'm safe, but convincing my nervous system of that is a totally different task.
Mm. As a child, what were some of the earliest signs, the emotional, physical? And I know that before Travis, there was some other issues, but as you started to see the earliest signs, it started to progress. You were in 13 plus schools. You never were locked in a system that you can trust, but also you never had that continuity. But for you, what were some of the earliest signs that you kind of could remember? Was it emotional? Was it physical? Was it behavioral as they were grooming you?
I don't think I grew up in a way to where my mind was conceptualizing right, wrong, normal or not. I think at that time, I was so focused on just getting the next meal or defending against the next attack that I didn't even have time to conceptualize that this was wrong. Or different. I think the time that I realized when things truly felt wrong was the first time that I was molested by Travis. Even though other men had molested me at that point, it was such weird and different situations. And it was in such, you know, there was the one I talked about in my Soft White Underbelly interview with the babysitter. And then Tanya always had a rotation of men. She would just go out and meet men at bars. She would pick up hitchhikers on the side of the road and put them in the car with us and go and have sex with them on the beach. You know, we used to live, just to clarify really quick, because it's confusing to think Oregon and beach, but there was a little place called Sovies Island. And it was like a little sandy island on the Columbia River that people went and had beach time. I think I started to notice things were weird. I did understand that picking up hitchhikers was not right. And I was mostly concerned about, we don't know this guy. And I remember one time she picked up this guy who ate our food. We had packed lunches to go that day, and he just ate all of our food in front of us. And I was like, okay, I guess we're not eating today. And then I think the first time Travis molested me was when I realized something was different. I didn't know what it was at that point, but I knew that my life at that point had changed. I felt filthy in my body. I stopped being able to eat. I used to love school, and I completely checked out. I would say that I just became a shell of myself, even as a child at that point. And, you know, I'd always had a pretty strong survival instinct, but for a while it died.
Hmm. You know, a lot of what you have talked to us about really speaks to just this particular situation. But for our listeners to understand, you also had to watch over your brother. And that was a lot of what kept you from trying anything at that point, whether it was running away or doing something drastic, just because you felt that sense of motherhood or parent for him as well as he had to deal. How difficult was those times for you to not really have that one person you can even speak to because he couldn't comprehend what was really happening?
I'm actually really glad that you brought up that point, because I think that's something that a lot of people miss is the sheer loneliness of being in that situation where all of the adults are insane and all of the kids are either too young, or my brother, who is mentally disabled, he can't read, he can't write. He's present and he can understand the conversations around him and he can speak back and forth with you, but it has declined over time. And it is very lonely because you can't do even if the abuse was not happening. You know, when I played with my brother, it got to a certain point where my age surpassed him and he couldn't keep up anymore. And so we would play video games and it would have to be kind of a more simple game. Or, you know, he doesn't have a cognitive memory. He can't say this person hurt me or, you know, recall something from the past and tell it to you. And so that puts me in the position of, you know, when I wanted to ask for help, there was literally, even though there were kids around me, there was nobody that could back me up. And, you know, it just made it lonely. And then, of course, the care, like you said, not being able to run with Brandon. There were times when we did have to run and hide. And one thing I didn't get to say in my interview is we used to build these teepees. And I don't know why, but I just got really good at building these teepees, and we would hide them out in the forest behind our house. And sometimes we did have to run and hide. And it was really hard to get him because, you know, we're having to climb down hills and jump over logs and trees, and we're having to try and be quiet while we're doing it and hide from these adults. And sometimes that wasn't possible with Brandon. And a lot of times that resulted in me having to take the brunt of whatever was happening in his place.
And listen, like a great sister, you took a lot of beatings, you fought for him. I love how you were telling the story about the bike got stole like 50 times. You kept going back for it and you had to fight for him and you took the beating. Look, got a black eye, but I got your bike back. Don't worry about it. You know, one of the things that a lot of us are learning about this is that there wasn't just one place. It was like you were boxed in a situation where Tanya would strategically do things such as move constantly. And when you had to pick up and move, it happened almost every time. You didn't know if you were going or coming. And that uncertainty of having to live that way. Now that this is starting to unfold, what was the relationship now between her, knowing that she knew what Travis had done? Did that change in context for her at all, or did it get worse for you?
So here's the thing is, at that time as a teenager, I truly believed that Tanya didn't know. And she would make us rehearse these lines that would basically just be defending her. And we weren't allowed to talk about what was happening to us. And even my closest friends at that time would try to get it out of me. And it was just, I was so brainwashed at that time that I just couldn't bring myself to tell them. And, you know, it's just, she is very skilled with that. I think the moving around was a tactic, and then brainwashing us was a tactic. And then, sorry, can you ask the question one more time? Because I want to make sure I'm hitting the point the right way.
Well, as far as Tanya, she understood that Travis had done something.
Oh, yeah.
Or did she just act like she did not know? Did it matter?
The first time it happened was in bed with her. And many times after that, she was very involved. And I don't know why. She has this really uncanny ability to just make you believe what she says. And especially when you're a child. Not now, but when I was a child, I would just, if she told me it wasn't happening, then fine, it wasn't happening. And then it got to a point, I think I was about 14 or 15, where I got up the courage to confront her about it. And I was actually cleaning. I was sweeping the floor in the trailer. I don't know why I was trying. That trailer could never be clean. But I was sweeping, and she was kind of standing. There was a kitchen and like a little hallway. And I was over here in the hallway, and she's standing in the kitchen. And I tell her, you know, Travis is doing stuff to me. And she doesn't say anything. And then I say it again. And then she turns around and she says, I can't afford to pay the bills. And that was that.
Wow. When you tried to disclose this for the first time and you saw that it hit a dead end, it did not work out. Tanya will use tactics such as, if you speak, you and your brother will be separated. And I'm going back to that because of the love that you have for your brother and how much you had to protect him. So she would use tactics such as, you will be separated, you will never see him. So that sort of control over you was taking place. And sometimes when you had the opportunity to be free, like when you were with your grandparents, were you able to disclose to them? And how did they respond to this?
I think this is where my grandparents fell short. They did all of the practical, logical things that needed to be done, such as putting us in therapy, putting us in sports and gymnastics. They even arranged friendships. They had a pool up in Washington, and they would hold pool parties and invite the neighborhood kids so that we could socialize. But where they fell short is that neither my grandma or my grandpa, I think, are very capable of a strong emotional context or conversation. I think their EQ is not quite as developed as it might be for other people in these generations. My grandma and I have never, not until I was in my 30s, was my grandma ever able to directly speak to me about it. And I think, honestly, the only reason that started to happen is because her mental health started to decline in her older years. She's kind of heading into dementia. And I think when her barriers started to break down, then she was able to express her guilt and her fear over everything that happened. But in the moment, I think she was working. I think it was hard as a mother to face what her daughter was capable of. And I think that, you know, she did bring us to church. And I think for her, church was the save all of everything.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, yeah, they I think they did what they knew how to do.
As a survivor, Jay, what do you wish someone would have told you when you were a child about this?
I think what I wish would have happened is when my grandparents stepped in and they put all that money and effort into, you know, paying off all Tanya's debts, and, you know, they thought that would fix everything. And it's not that their fault that Tanya did come with the police, and my grandparents are very law-abiding. They're very by the book, very rule followers. You know, if an officer tells them what to do, they're going to do it. And Tanya's the opposite, unless it works in her favor. And I wish in that moment they had been a little bit more rebellious toward the police. I think that they were both very conditioned to listen to authority. And in that moment, I think they needed to push back. Because after that, when Tanya took us with the police is when she moved us to Virginia, because at that point she'd burned too many bridges and too many people were picking up on what was going on. And I think we could have avoided a lot of that isolation if my grandparents might have been brave enough to push back on the police.
A lot of what I'm learning about is the weight of this betrayal that you had to deal with, that your brother had to deal with, when your protector is really the perpetrator. This relational trauma really impacts the different ways that we feel, but also the harm that we receive from strangers. And when it's a family member, it can fracture our entire worldview about how things are. And understanding that when we are talking to our children, we need to understand to validate what they are saying to us. We need to believe what a child is saying immediately without judgment, just to support what it is and do your thorough investigation to really get an understanding of what this child may or may not be experiencing. As you mentioned before, it's too late. Mm-hmm. What are, in your experiences, what are kind of the support that matters most when a child has been impacted by this? Is it the flooding of supports and therapy? Is it just being there for the child? And tell us a little bit about your talks when you do speak to people at large about this.
I think one of the issues that made it really hard to speak is that when I was contacted in school by CPS and DSS, at least in Virginia, they made it feel like I was in trouble. Like, they called me out of the middle of my class. They made me sit in the principal's office. Nobody said why I was there. They put me in a different office and I was waiting. I had no idea what was going on. And by the time they came in, they started hammering me with questions with no soft or gentle lead up. Yeah. And I was like, I felt like I was in trouble the whole time. And then they were getting frustrated at me for my answers because I was giving them the answers that Tanya had rehearsed. And I think if they had just taken the time to make it a little bit more gentle, that probably would have been a lot more opening up. Like, there's a school in Hawaii where it is one person's job to just be friends with the students. And they pair him with at-risk students or students who are having issues at school. And instead of going in with the hard-hammered questions, he builds a friendship with them. And then they naturally open up to him. And he's been able to uncover things that were going on at home, missing parents, abusive dads, and things like that, simply by being a friend and being a listener. And I understand the urgency and the fear involved on the adult part when they find out something horrible is happening to a child. But if you take that fear into the room with the child who's already in survival mode, you're not going to get the answers that need to be said.
If you could redesign how communities respond to this disclosure of abuse, like, what would that look like for you?
Okay. I have actually designed a system to replace foster care in the way that it handles children who have to be removed from their homes. My approach is educational, empathetic, and compassionate, and it's also monitored in a way that prevents and detects possible grooming. Because I think one of the issues is that sometimes the only person to show up to that child as a friend is another groomer who spots an easy victim. Because I think a lot of kids get re-traumatized by unsafe adults working in supposedly safe adult spaces. And then another thing is to actually build a relationship with that child and show up consistently, which is hard to do in an emergency situation. I think one of the issues that I had is at school, they were able to separate me from the harmful adults, but the CPS visits to my house, they didn't separate me from my abuser. I had to answer questions about my abuser in front of my abuser. So I'm not going to tell you the truth. They're standing right there. Like, they're going to hurt me when you leave. Like, you know, so no child is going to speak up in that situation.
I think that's a great point, because as children, it takes a lot of courage to really step up and to do something about it. And when you finally do, you find yourself caught up in where fear and shame and confusion, you're like, you were supposed to help me and this went backwards. I can't really understand, who am I supposed to get trust from now? When you were thinking about the Boundary Bandits, can you tell me how your survival kind of shaped the mission?
Yeah, I think the reason that I came up with Boundary Bandits in the way that I did is because, first of all, I wanted children to be involved in their own education. If you watch children's shows, you have one friendly adult and then a bunch of kids leading the charge. You know, it's their world. You're entering their world and speaking to them on their level. And I think if you're trying to speak to a kid, even a parentified kid, from an adult perspective, there's going to be a disconnect there. Obviously, I don't want anything that happened to me to happen to another kid. I think a lot of the things that we teach are, they don't teach the kid to be powerful in themselves. There's a lot of emphasis put on obeying and listening and keeping quiet and doing as told. And there's less emphasis put on actually understanding what's going on around you and understanding that not every adult is safe and not every rule makes sense. And, you know, it's natural for kids to press boundaries as they learn and grow, but they also need to learn to create boundaries and know what those are. There's really great moms and things online now who actively show, work with their kids on safe touch, unsafe touch, who is safe to talk to, simple things like having a family password, which, you know, those things aren't going to work if it's your family who's causing the abuse. But if it's an adult outside of your family, I think it's a little easier to work with that. So, and I think my approach too is influenced by just the fact of being an artist and a diver, the same way that we have to approach creating solutions that don't yet exist, and then having a focus on prevention instead of treating after the fact, which I think is a huge problem. You know, I want to hit it from all angles, and my goal is to reach it at the root and work growing something from there than starting after the harm has already hit.
One thing I want to disclose to the audience here, people who are listening, is that you were still a straight A student above all this. Incredible to even think about. You know, it's almost unbelievable to kind of think about that. So really kudos to you and to your resilience. When you are working with children and teaching them about boundaries, how do you balance protecting their innocence and also giving them the tools at the same time?
I think it helps to dissect where this idea of innocence is coming from, because if you're approaching the idea of innocence as like a religious idea, to where you want to preserve something holy and pure in them, I think that can kind of lean toward a radical idealism that's not realistic for the world that we live in. But I think if you focus more on allowing your child to be a child while also being an aware child, I think that's a little bit healthier of a concept, because you do want your child to learn and explore, and you do want your child to be able to develop their own skills. And you also want them to still, maybe you still want them to believe in the tooth fairy or be able to just enjoy the discovering of life on Earth. But I think that's more of a mindset rather than trying to preserve a form of purity. And I think if we can separate that and let go of this idea, because the thing is if you don't protect their innocence while there's active predators who are trying to take that innocence, I'm sorry, what I meant to say is if you're trying to protect this concept of innocence that other people are trying to attack and take from them, I think the focus is just in the wrong spot. Your child can still be a learning, growing, developing child with plenty of wonder and joy in the world, while also knowing that not everything is Blue's Clues and Peppa Pig. It's
What's your relationship with Tanya and Travis, if you do have one with them?
I went no contact with Tanya, I think, the first time in my 20s, pretty much as soon as I started going to therapy as an adult. And they started unwinding all the brainwashing she had done. I think the last time I was truly friendly with Tanya was in about 2013. And that would have been during the time when I did have about 4 to 5 years of active addiction, where I just got into the wrong life, the wrong crowd. And I, instead of using it as a self-destructive thing, my time in addiction was high functioning. I worked a lot. I basically just used it to work and work and work. And I think I was getting value from the same way I did at school, like just having that, all of my socials and everything, also my social connections and fun were tied to work. And so doing drugs for me was a way that I could get that connection with people at work. And then when I realized that's not the type of connection I want in my life, I also started looking at the other connections that I still had in my life, such as Tanya. With Travis, I haven't had any contact with Travis since I ran away from Virginia. The last time I saw him was the last time Tanya dropped me off with him in a motel to be essayed. And that was the last time. And then after that, I took Brandon and we ran back to Oregon. And then with Tanya, it used to be very complicated. Now for me, it's very simple. During my active addiction, I still believed there was a mother that I could connect with. And sometimes I could be emotionally baited by her. Sometimes I could still engage. As I grew up, I realized that this is just who she is. She's never going to be a better person. She might be able to put on a mask and present in a certain way, but the way that she speaks to me and sees me is very degrading still. And even after she saw my soft white underbelly video, she called me a liar and a skank. She, you know, so nothing has changed. We're still there.
It's something when you break the narcissist down and you see them for who they are, it's interesting how they have no power over you.
Yeah.
And what turns out of them. Tell me about Brandon. And are you in contact with him? And what's that like?
Tons of control over Brandon. She's never going to let him go unless he's legally taken away, because she doesn't want to work and he gets social security and disability checks. And that's kind of what she's been living off of our whole lives, if she's not living off of a man. I think she had a job when I was maybe 4, 5, 6 years old, and that's the last time I've seen her work a job. But with Brandon, I try to stay in contact with him whenever contact is allowed. I send him gifts. I used to send him healthy groceries because they had a really poor diet, and to me, just nutrition is very important. So I used to try and get them to stop drinking soda, and I would send them kombucha, flavored kombuchas and things like that. And he likes photography and art, but he is limited in what he can do. So I sent him a little Instax camera, and I sent him colorful film and things like that. So he knows that I'm still here. The last time I saw him in person was in June 2021. Tanya had arranged somewhat of a family reunion with half of the family. And they went out to Oregon, and I flew from Hawaii to meet them there. And, you know, there was drama, but I got to see my brother, and, you know, I got to spend time with him. And I guess technically kidnapped him, but I did take him away from that part of the family to meet the part of the family that he hadn't seen in some time, my grandparents and things like that. So we got to have our time together. And at that time, you know, I'm willing to take the consequences to do the right thing. I don't really care. I never really grew up with a sense of respect for authority because of the way authority really mishandled me my whole life. So I'm not too worried. And I also know that pushing back on systems is the best way to change them sometimes.
It is so remarkable to kind of hear that you still have a big heart on top of all of this that has happened. You've been all over the place. Tell me how you got into this action plan for Hawaii. Was that something that you had that goal, or you just, all right, Hawaii is the spot?
It's a little bit of a funny story. So my grandparents had taken me to Hawaii as a kid because they had a condo out on Big Island. And so I already had happy memories of going there with my grandparents. And then as an adult, I had moved back to Oregon temporarily. I'd run away from Virginia. I did my last year and a half of high school out there. And then I went to a trade school, and then I went back to Oregon. And I spent about 5, 6 miserably cold years there, and I just hate to be cold. And so I was traveling to warm places, and I actually was dancing at that time. I became a pole dancer for that time, and I ended up winning a competition for Miss Exotic Oregon. And technically another girl had won, and they found out later that she had cheated, and I was second place by a single point. And so they called me and gave me the crown and whatnot. And I had still won second place. I'd still won a good amount of money, and I took that money and moved to Hawaii. I said, peace out.
Tell us a little bit about your work now. How are women and parents receiving you and your story as you're doing these talks around the world?
I'm actually getting a lot of women, and I'm surprised at how many men are actually showing up. The men are more private. I would say the women speak to me in comments, and the men fill up my inbox. And there's a lot of trauma dumping, which is fine. I don't care. To me, trauma dumping is just somebody who hasn't had their story heard yet. And, you know, mostly people are feeling heard. I started telling stories where I put infographics with definitions of therapy terms, healed responses and unhealed reactions to manipulation tactics. And people are finding that incredibly helpful. People are writing to me about how it's helped them unravel their own trauma. It's helped them put words to understanding what has been going on in their lives. There's people who tell me that they share my lessons with their kids. And, you know, it's really beautiful. I'm very flattered. I didn't necessarily, you know, I wanted to change the foster care system, and I was coming from a place of education, but I understand that there are trained professionals in the world who are doing this, you know, throughout their whole lives. And I am working with a team of trained professionals. I'm not just coming up with everything willy-nilly. But I am finding that people feel seen, heard, and people are telling me that I'm bridging the gap between the conceptualized theory of what's going on and actually applying it to life. And they're actually able to take that and use it.
Tell us about your world of photography. I know that when you started learning about diving, and then you started doing it professionally, and you started looking at that. Tell us a little bit about that, Jay.
Yeah, I would say I've always been attracted to the ocean. I think that water is very healing for a lot of people, not just me. My grandma was also really big into the ocean. She always took me, when she took me to Hawaii, she took me snorkeling and swimming and stuff like that. And everywhere I went, I was just always attracted to the ocean. And then I realized that because of everything I'd been through in the past, I just had no fear where other people were terrified. And so I just kept pushing my limits. It started with, you know, realizing I could hold my breath for several minutes at a time, and then actually taking a freediving course and doing it correctly. And then I had my first dive. I actually had a friend who, when I became clean and sober, rewarded me with a trip to Fiji. And on that trip to Fiji, I had my first scuba dive, and it was game over from there. My very first dive ever, I flipped off the back of the boat as instructed. First time having a tank strapped to my body, and I'm in the water and the bubbles are all floating up and clearing around me. And then I realized a lot of these were not bubbles. They were actually teeth. And I was floating in the middle of a school of barracuda. And they're so creepy because they don't move. They're completely still. And they're just, I'm just looking at their teeth and their eyes. And I had a moment where I was like, shit. Like, I didn't know what to do. I froze. And then my instructor popped in the water after me. And then he hooked me to a little leash and swam me around. And so my very first dive experience was a little creepy. And then from there, I realized, you know, they didn't do anything to me. They stayed where they were. We saw about 9 sharks on that first dive, and I was in love. I realized that I had the kind of resilience and courage that I could do some really cool stuff.
I know that when we first started talking and I alluded to your book and all these things that are coming out, what's in the works about that, and what should we be expecting?
So I did start writing my book about 2.5-3 years ago. People who met me, and if I shared a little bit about my life, they just wanted to know more. And so many people had asked me to write a book that I did start writing it. And then it felt a little selfish to just be writing about myself the whole time like that. And so because I realized that I was one of many kids in this situation, and there's still plenty of kids out there in this situation, and people showing up in the comments telling me all the time about the same stuff that they have in common with me. And then I started looking at the bigger picture of realizing that not only is this a generational thing, but there's social, political, and history context that all contributes to this. I'm writing my memoir, and it is about me and what happened to me, but it's in the context that I hope is more inviting to a wider audience of people who grew up in the U.S. as the grandchildren of the people from the industrial age. Because I do want to put it in context of the type of personalities and society that was needed at that time, and how a lot of abuse came from that as we evolved and became wiser human beings, you know. And now we're living in this world where we've got one foot in the past, where we've been raised from people who thought emotions were weakness, to now we're living in a world where soft skills determine your success. So that's the context of my memoir.
What would you tell the younger you, now that you know all the things that you know, and I know that you went through so much and are still dealing, but what would you tell the young Jay?
I would give her one hell of a fist bump. I would. When I look back and I see everything she was doing, I am so proud of her. You know, I'm going to cry a little bit, but I think I would have just let her know that, you know, she was doing everything on her own. There was no encouragement. There was no safety. There was nothing. And I would just let her know that she's not alone, and she's going to be really awesome one day.
Such a beautiful story it is. And in order to learn from this world, sometimes we got to have great people, amazing people like yourself, to have the courage. And always sending, since we met, I just continuously send positive energy for you and for your plight and this work, because it means so much to so many people. And I know that you don't do it for the accolades, because you're so humble. Above all of this, you are probably one of the friendliest and humblest people that someone can ever meet. What do you plan to do with this when this becomes to uncover to a place of, now I have the platform, what I am going to show them now?
Thank you for asking. So this is actually a plan. The plan that I set in motion is that as I was writing my memoir, I also started developing my plan to replace foster care. And then I realized that I was going to have to gain public support, because I can't afford it by myself. And with the availability of the internet and global exposure and those kind of things these days, I realized if I was going to be able to take action for building the plan that I have, that I could use the resources that I have. So my plan was to share my story so that people understand where I'm coming from and why this is so important, and give them a connection point. And I have created a GoFundMe for anybody who wants to directly support me. I also keep a Substack where I write a blog, and that's where my lighter content is. It's not as heavy as everything else. And I actually also just got my Patreon approved, where I'm going to be sharing more of the graphic details of the abuse, the public records and things, if people want to go internet sleuth and dig a little deeper. Yeah. And that money will be used to fund the legal fees to press charges against Tanya and Travis. I'm also considering pressing charges against Oregon and Virginia because of how they assisted in putting us in harm's way, removing us from a safe home and putting us in harm's way with convicted sex offenders. And then that will be the money that I use to reveal and seed my project for replacing foster care.
Could you tell us the names or addresses of how our listeners can support you, and where should they go?
Sure. Yeah. Everything is searchable by my name. My name is Jay Tracy, JAETRACY. And you can find me on YouTube and Instagram. You can follow me on Facebook, and I do have public posts there, but I'll just let you know that I don't add any friends on Facebook because that is for my private circle. But there are public posts there. People want to see them. Substack is where you can subscribe for free, or you can pledge a monthly amount if you want the lighter content, if you just want to see my artwork and you want to see the results of my labor without going too deep into the more traumatizing stuff. And then Patreon is going to be where the traumatizing stuff is, where you can dig deeper if you have the capacity to and the desire to see the details, the court records, and if you want to directly support my legal fees. And then YouTube is where I break down my stories and where I go into my actual trauma education and boundary education.
Yeah, we need the truth, girl. Yeah, let us know. That's right. Before we let you go, the floor is yours. Anything you want to leave our listeners with? Anybody who's struggling with this work, tell us.
Yeah, I would say if you're struggling, there's always people out there. They might not be in your immediate circle, but if you can get online, you can get connected with somebody. There's somebody out there who's going through what you're going through. They might be on Reddit, they might be on YouTube. But also, I would say, even if the things that you went through are really difficult and dark and shameful and painful, and there's all this complication, I would say the healthiest thing you can do is still cultivate fun and joy into your healing. It doesn't always have to be this dreadful drudge through the past. You can take, you know, like I mentioned in my other video, you can take the skills that you've had to develop, and you don't have, you sure, you can disassociate and you can be resilient and you can have hypervigilance, but those don't have to be symptoms or problems. Those can be skills that you develop, and you can even consider them elite skills that other people don't have. And I highly encourage people to have fun with it. You know, it doesn't always have to be terrible.
You know, friends, doors make positive changes to your mindset, because sometimes they open, sometimes they close. Unlock your potential by taking more risk. You heard today how you can unfasten the roadblocks that can hold you back. Unbolt your motivation to finish what you started. One door opens, the other one closes. Don't let anyone step into your dreams with their nightmares. Because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Jay, thank you so much for such an amazing conversation. Blessings to you, Queen.
Thank you so much.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde de la Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.